Support for WMFE comes from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University's worldwide campus, where highly ranked online degree programs offer the flexibility to learn what students want from wherever they are. More at erau.edu/worldwide.
Artemis 3 gets its crew, and Florida wants to see rocket launches from the sea. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. NASA announced the crew of four for its upcoming Artemis 3 mission. It's a critical test flight of the Orion spacecraft aimed at rendezvousing and docking with up to two human landers designed to take astronauts to the lunar surface.
This mission is going to be fantastic. What an excellent crew. Very proud to serve with these gentlemen. Very fine crew. And go Artemis, go NASA.
We'll learn more about this crew and just how important this mission is to NASA's ambitious moon plans with veteran NASA astronaut Nicole Stott. Then Space Florida wants to see more launches from Florida and more launches from the water just off the state's coastline. While the Space Coast isn't out of land to launch rockets from just yet, one Florida space leader says now is the time to invest in new ways to send stuff into space.
Getting out away from the land also frees you up from a safety perspective, right? There's not as many safety constraints, right? So you have more flexibility. So there's a lot of appeal to a sea-based type of alternative or platform.
We hear from Space Florida CEO Rob Long on the push to launch rockets from the sea. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? NASA has announced the crew of the next Artemis mission. NASA's Randy Breznik is commanding the mission, along with fellow astronauts Frank Rubio and Andre Douglas as mission specialists. European Space Agency astronaut Luca Parmitano will serve as mission pilot. The crew will pilot the Orion space capsule in Earth orbit and test its rendezvous and docking abilities with both commercially designed human landing vehicles. While it's not going to the moon, it's a critical test flight to get astronauts to the surface of the moon on the next mission. Here's Commander Randy Breznik.
Now, spaceflight is hard, and that's why the most important Artemis mission will always be the next Artemis mission.
Getting assigned to a crew is a big milestone in an astronaut's career. Here to talk more about what comes next for this crew of four is an astronaut who was assigned two missions, space shuttle flights and a long-duration stay on the International Space Station, veteran NASA astronaut Nicole Stott. Nicole, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
Thank you. Always good to be here. Like we're there yet all the time, yeah.
Yes, we're almost there, right?
almost there. All the time.
Well, one step closer to getting humans back to the moon with Artemis 3 and the announcement of that crew. You know, I know it's just been a few hours for you, but what's your first reaction to hearing who this crew is?
Just excited. It was a little bit surprising for me. I don't know who in my mind exactly I had thought it would be, but I was a bit surprised today. And happily, you know, I mean, for any one of those four people up there, this is a really extraordinary thing. And all of them are really, you know, amazing human beings. And some I've known a lot longer than others. But wow, I mean, the word was wow, I think.
Walk us through what a moment is for an astronaut like this. You've been assigned to two missions, if I recall correctly. What is the process like? Like, when do you know? Obviously, these guys didn't know this morning. when did you know?
Yeah, they knew. I mean, they had pictures and all. I don't think they did all that this morning. But yeah, it kind of depends, you know. For long duration spaceflight, it was, you know, a few years out that you find out, because you're going to go through a backup crew, or, you know, and I think we're still doing that, you know, where you have backup crews and then you roll into the prime crew. So that's a few years out. And for a shuttle flight, like my second one was, that was actually I got the call for that while I was on the space station. So I had just gotten there for my first flight. And I got a call one day from the ground about would I want to be on the final flight of the space shuttle program. And I'm like, well, yeah, you know, and which then turned into STS-133, which was not the final flight because we got an extra one added on. And so it's just really, it really depends. And sometimes you'll get called into the office and sometimes you'll get a phone call in space. You just never know.
You know, from the surface, this mission doesn't seem very complex. It's staying in low Earth orbit. It's not going to the moon. But NASA leaders have called this a highly complex mission. Can you talk to us a bit about what makes this so challenging?
I think he's absolutely right, you know, and I think it was really brilliant to add this flight in to the mix before we send, you know, Artemis 4 or, you know, I mean, that's what we're planning now, Artemis 4 to have crew actually land on the moon. You know, we're at a point where we're trying to accelerate things a little bit. We have vehicles that, you know, have not been proven out yet. I mean, you think about the lander side of it. And this is an opportunity to really bring all of the expertise to bear on the ground and in space to check those very critical components out before we go, you know, sling ourselves around the moon and then want to land on it again. It's all new stuff. And I don't know, I was reflecting today as I was hearing about this, you know, as the announcement was going on, as the other presenters were, you know, whether it was the science or the status of the program, and, you know, thinking about like the Apollo 7 and the Apollo 9 missions too, you know, that were very preparatory for what we would need to have ready to go, like ready to go, not questioning whether it's ready to go, but ready to go when we decided to push the button and land on the moon. So I think this is, you know, this is a complexity that's, you know, part of the bigger picture of just getting back to the moon in general, but it absolutely is the fill in the blanks for some of the, you know, the very critical components and operations and procedures that we just haven't done yet. And maybe hadn't even done them 50 years ago, right? Because of the equipment that we're going to be using this time.
Right. And to commercial companies that are largely designing and developing these systems, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And in a very different way than we did over 50 years ago, right? I mean, every step of the way, I always like to think about it, you know, is that NASA has always had commercial companies working with them, right? As contractors on board to, whether that was building the space shuttle or, you know, Apollo lander or, you know, the rocket ships. It's always been companies doing that in partnership with NASA, but it's very different now. I mean, these are public-private commercial partnerships that are of a very different nature than they have been all along. And I think that's, you know, that's something that we're going to, you know, we've been playing it out with what we're doing on the International Space Station. I think it's a really, you know, it's a really wonderful example of how we can bring innovation to life by partnering in different ways and utilizing partners in different ways. And this is going to be a big deal with that too. And the international partnerships that are, you know, that go along with it too.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with veteran NASA astronaut Nicole Stott about the selection of the Artemis 3 crew. Nicole, we'll talk a little bit about, you know, who you know in this particular crew, but I want to ask you about Andre Douglas. This is going to be his first space flight, which is very exciting. What advice do you have for him as he embarks on his first space flight that is incredibly complex that we've just discussed?
Yeah, you know, I like to think that, you know, there's complexity in all of these missions that we do. Even if you look at a space station flight where it seems like, you know, we're sending another crew to the space station, it's just the same. It is not. There is, a level of complexity with all of the work that we do in space. And, you know, and we send rookies to do it. Look at how Jeremy did Hansen on this, you know, this man who's his first flight and he's, you know, he's slingshotting around the moon. I mean, it was extraordinary. And, you know, and how well. I think it's a real testament to the training that we do here on Earth and to the way that we leverage the experienced people with the new rookie people. And Andre just went through this whole process with the Artemis 2 crew, right? You know, backing them up side by side with those folks as they were preparing for Artemis 2. And I think there's a lot that he has probably gained already from that experience. And, you know, there's a reason why we put people as backups. You know, they're eventually going to fly and utilize that experience. I just say go with it. You know, it's, you've got this amazing training. You've got, you know, three super experienced people that you're flying with. You have the experience of those four that you just backed up, and you just go with it. It's going to be, I know, I wish I could be packed in the luggage if nothing else.
So NASA also has Randy Bresnik and Frank Rubio along with the European Space Agency's Luca Parmitano on this flight as well. Do you have any experience with those three guys?
I met Frank very briefly. You know, he was on his way in as I was retiring from NASA. But just watching the flight experience that he had, I mean, look at his just career experience too. Another one of these people that, you know, I remember sitting around the table doing astronaut selection with some of these folks and thinking, holy, I remember talking to Megan MacArthur about this at the end of an interview day, like, I don't think we'd hire ourselves anymore, you know, just because of these people coming through, right? And so he's one of those guys that, you know, very confident with him. Luca and Randy, I know much better. I never flew with Luca, but did some training with him along the way. And he was one of the really wonderful supporters of the Space for Art Foundation activities that we have going on too. I'm going to have to pull out some pictures to send to him. And Randy was on the STS-129 flight, which was the crew that brought me home from the space station on my first flight. So I consider myself a part of the STS-129 crew too, and have gotten to know Randy and Rebecca and his family quite well over the years, and was really surprised and excited to see him walk out as commander of the flight.
There was a moment at the end of this announcement where the Artemis II crew came out and passed along the baton. Very symbolic moment, but it also reminded me that all eyes were on Artemis II, and really it captured not only the American public, but the global public. Does Artemis III still have that same ability?
I think so, and I hope so. You know, I look at this, you know, it's one of the things I appreciate about Jared and the philosophy going forward too, is this momentum. Like keeping this, you know, they could easily have not invited the Artemis II crew up, right? It would have seemed weird not to, but they did, and it was just this, like it was meant to be, you know, this handing, you know, off of the baton. I've never seen that physically happen that way before, but that was pretty cool. And I think that we can keep that same momentum going too. The excitement, I think kind of the surprise too, that people felt following along with the Artemis II crew and knowing that these are the stepping stones, right, to getting those steps back on the moon. And I love today how it was continuously mentioned. I think all of the speakers in one way or another reminded us that this is with the goal of a permanent presence on the moon, in the moon, and all the ways that we're going to be able to, you know, have a presence there and, you know, bring that goodness back to Earth as well as, you know, onto Mars and, you know, wherever else we might decide to go someday. But I'd be really surprised if the excitement didn't carry forward. And I'm really grateful to NASA and partners for just actively sharing it with us. I mean, there was no like, oh, I wonder what the Artemis II crew is doing today. It was just part of what you could go, you know, look at if you wanted to and follow along with. And I think that's really the way it should be.
It's an all-male crew. This is something where they're going to be testing key systems of usability. The fact that there's not a woman on this crew, is that a disappointment?
You know, I was really hopeful, and there's a couple of people I have in mind. I just, you know, I won't say those names, but I am really, you know, I'm just like, well, maybe their boots will be the ones walking on the moon. I think, you know, one of the things we try to say to kids all the time is, you know, the spaceship doesn't care if you're a boy or girl, right? And I think in the selection process, there's criteria and there's people and it works out the way it does. And as much as honestly, I would have loved to see a woman walk out on that stage today, I don't think it is any disservice to the women in the astronaut office. And I am looking forward to, you know, to the women that will come in the future missions and how we will see them, you know, playing really, really critical, important roles on the surface and around the moon.
Nicole Stott, veteran NASA astronaut, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Still to come, the push to launch rockets from the sea, why Florida wants to lead the charge. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne.
After more than a decade, a mission to study the atmosphere of Mars and its evolution has ended. NASA officially ended the MAVEN mission after an unexpected loss of signal in December. We'll talk about its legacy from two scientists on the mission. That's next time on Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about launching rockets from sea. Space Florida, the state agency that helps bring space business to Florida, is helping Seagate Space launch rockets from water. The agency is investing about $270,000 into equipment to lease back to the startup to build a prototype at the port Tampa Bay. It's part of the growing effort to get more stuff into space from Florida, and leading that charge is Rob Long. He's the president and CEO of Space Florida and joins us now. Rob, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So sea launch, this sounds really exciting. Tell me a bit about what's coming to Florida's coastline.
Well, when we talk about the sea-based launch alternatives that we've looked at, obviously that's something that is not necessarily new. There have been companies that have demonstrated this capability in the past. But as you look more holistically, as the spaceport transportation activity grows worldwide, and of course we sit at the busiest spaceport in the world right here in Florida, we want to make sure we're evolving and supporting those innovative companies that are, you know, looking at new and novel ways to grow the capability, and obviously remain right here in Florida, take advantage of Florida's seaport system as well. It's our spaceport system. So it, you know, Seagate directly obviously has a pretty novel concept and what they're going to do. And so it's a really exciting time for us to be able to support them.
You mentioned it's a novel concept. I mean, is this happening anywhere else that you can take a look and see some best practices, or really is Florida going to be the one that's leading the charge when it comes to this?
Well, I think you see several companies, and maybe not several, but there are some other companies out there that are certainly looking at this option now. And as I mentioned, sea launch has actually been successfully accomplished, or launching from sea has been done successfully in the past. But I think with the advent of more modern reusability, when we talk about on the launch vehicle side, it starts to make the business case a little more appealing for some of these alternative options to your traditional land-based platforms. But I think when you look at it as an integrated whole, this is why we think it's so important for Florida, why we think it makes sense to do it here in Florida. Not only the fact that, of course, like I said, we have the world's busiest spaceport right here in Cape Canaveral, but we also can take advantage of the overall statewide infrastructure that exists to support companies like this. So, you know, Seagate's one, there are a couple others that are looking at this. And I think we've seen this type of activity start to mature a little bit more, even internationally. So while it's not a new concept necessarily, I think making sure that it's more efficient and more effective as an evolving and then longer term strategic, let's say, option, it's certainly something pretty appealing.
You mentioned Florida being one of the busiest space ports as kind of a draw for the company to come here and do this. But is that also motivation for Florida to have something like this set up? I'm asking, are we out of launch pads? Is that what the driving factor is?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we're not out of launch pads, and there's a lot of land area that could still theoretically be developed, whether that's at Kennedy Space Center or Cape Canaveral Space Force Station. But over time, as the demand signal rises with any transportation activity, whether it's an airport or a seaport, or in our case, a spaceport, you're naturally going to come up against constraints. And so this is the time where we aren't constrained necessarily at the moment, but this is where you want to start looking at those alternative options, doing the smart thing strategically to find those innovative ideas that allow you to then take advantage of what we already have from a statewide infrastructure perspective, but more importantly, blend, you know, a really innovative group of people that are looking at a new way of doing business and then take advantage of that. You know, for example, a couple of years ago, Space Florida led the study to help look at wharf expansion for maritime support right directly at Cape Canaveral, in Port Canaveral there. And one of the things that we incorporated in that study was this potential for some sort of sea-based platform that could be integrated into the spaceport directly. So while you might have all of the supporting infrastructure, still resident someplace like a Cape Canaveral, for example. The actual launch is then what happened out to sea. And on top of just the land constraints that we may or may not come up with up against sometime in the future, getting out away from the land also frees you up from a safety perspective, right? There's not as many safety constraints, right? So you have more flexibility. So there's a lot of appeal to a sea-based type of alternative or platform that would allow us to really, really be flexible while still retaining kind of the, or taking advantage of the overall infrastructure that we've invested in over the last decade plus here in Florida.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because I was going to ask you, you know, when it does come to safety, what happened at Blue Origin's pad recently comes to mind as well. So with something like, you know, a sea launch capability, not only do you have to not worry about safety, but companies can push the envelope a little more, right, when it comes to testing new rockets.
Yeah, I mean, obviously public safety, having served in the military before as a former commander at a spaceport, you know, that was the number one responsibility is public safety and making sure we do things in a safe way. I think, obviously, I defer to Blue Origin on all the specifics, but I think what it represents is, you know, no one was hurt. And I think that's, you know, an outcome of really good safety practices. But you're right, as you move forward, especially if you start to do things that are maybe even more cutting edge, you know, if you're out in the middle of the ocean, naturally, right, there's less of a chance of causing damage to something else. And so it does maybe potentially give you more flexibility in terms of whether it's pushing the envelope or turning things faster, being able to do more out on what we would call the range or, you know, the area that supports space launch activity is something that I think is worth exploring.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Rob Long. He is the president and CEO of Space Florida. We are talking about launching rockets at sea. Rob, do we have any indication as to what kinds of rockets we'll be launching there? I see you're in your office right now. It looks like you got a ULA a Vulcan behind you. Are we looking at something that's that large, or are these much smaller rockets that'll be launching from these pads?
Well, I think, you know, obviously I defer to Seagate specifically on what they're looking for. I think they just signed a partnership with Lockheed Martin. I think initially you're going to see it's going to be on the smaller size, right? Just generally smaller launch vehicles, the size of the platforms are as you can imagine, also smaller relative to what we talk about where some of the larger launch vehicles. So I think in terms of evolution, you know, you start with something like that, you're able to prove the concept, you're able to demonstrate the value proposition, the economics behind this type of an approach. And then, you know, over time, obviously, you know, the idea of a larger launch vehicle launching from a platform out in sea is certainly something that's been contemplated. But the investment required to do that obviously will take some, as you mentioned earlier, the business case needs to close. And I think we'll see how that plays out over time.
And you mentioned this, how will, you know, companies like Seagate or other companies that decide to do this utilize the infrastructure of Florida? When you say infrastructure, we're talking about, you know, the port is one piece of the infrastructure, but what other things will these companies need to utilize throughout the state?
Well, you know, as I mentioned, you know, once they get into operations, they would be able to take advantage of whether we would call what we call payload processing or fueling. Some of that infrastructure exists at the spaceports themselves, and that would be really no different than any other launch related activity, I think. But more importantly, something that I think Seagate gets to take advantage of are the maritime capabilities and infrastructure that's at our seaports across the state. So not only do we have this unique spaceport system, which is obviously Cape Canaveral, and that's kind of our anchor node for the network, but we also have two other licensed spaceports. We have additional spaceport territories across the state that would be prepared to support, depending on how Seagate or anybody really in the future kind of develops. But as I said, we can also look to the maritime infrastructure, which is incredibly important and incredibly developed here in the state of Florida. So it's really a nice nexus between what we already are doing on the spaceport side with something that's been longstanding on the maritime side.
Finally, Rob, you know, When you first took this position, we had a conversation about your vision for Florida. I spoke with your predecessor a lot about his vision for what Florida was like. I'm going to ask you to pull out your crystal ball here and say, you know, in 10 years with all of the launch infrastructure that we have at land, with something like, you know, sea launches, how many launches are we going to see in 2036?
You know, it's a great question, something that we have really been kind of focusing on. And obviously, our federal partners are keenly interested in understanding exactly what that looks like. One of the things I've been really interested in understanding better, and the team's been working on, is transitioning how we approach this. And it's something that we probably didn't even talk about when I first started. But when you consider any other mode of transportation, whether that's air travel or sea-based, typically when you talk about moving cargo, you talk in tonnage. How much tonnage are you moving through that system? And in space, we've always focused on the launch numbers in terms of the numbers of launches. And that's an incredibly important number to understand, because all of the operations demands drive resource requirements and infrastructure impacts and similar. But as we've talked about internally, and of course this is no great secret, you know, doing three launches a day is different than maybe three launches per week. But if you had three launches per day and then you sat for 2 weeks, for example, right, is that the same kind of impact on the system? It's hard to say. So what we have kind of shifted to thinking about is, what's the overall tonnage that we're requiring? For example, how much stuff are we moving from point A to point B? Same conversation you didn't have in any mode of transportation. Point A just happens to be on Earth. Point B happens to be in space somewhere. But if you look at like the 109 launches that we had last year out of the Cape, I think the metric tons are like around 1,300 metric tons to orbit. And we did just a really simple linear extrapolation over the next 10 years. And I said, if that was the case, if that was the trend, then that would be something on the order of about 5,000 metric tons in 10 years, which drives an interesting conversation, because while that might be 200 launches of a smaller size launch vehicle because of payload volume, it might only be, let's say, 50 launches of a large vehicle like a Starship or a New Glenn, right? Which are, those are two different impacts to the system overall. So what we'll be monitoring just as we go forward is that thesis of is metric tons, is tonnage the right thing to track? And then how can we help, you know, the system at large, of course, how can we collaborate with our federal partners to try to understand, you know, how best can we invest? You know, the state's invested over $500 million in spaceport infrastructure to date, and we're going to continue to do that. We just want to do it in a close, tight collaboration with NASA and the Space Force, so we understand, you know, how best to do that.
Rob Long is the president and CEO of Space Florida. He's in charge of getting stuff into space from Florida. More stuff.
That's right. More
Thanks
stuff.
So much for joining us, Rob.
Absolutely. Appreciate the time.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. And if you got an idea for a future episode of this show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. We're at arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance comes from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.